Perhaps I might have suspected something if I hadn't been so immersed in the multitudinous details of Project Ares that I'd no opportunity of taking the wider view. Looking back on it afterward, of course, I knew there were all sorts of hints and warnings, but I never noticed any of them at the time. True, I was vaguely aware that Jim Hutchins, my young American assistant, was becoming increasingly abstracted, as if he had something on his mind. Once or twice I had to pull him up for some minor inefficiency. Each time he looked hurt and promised it wouldn't happen again. He was one of those typical, clean-cut college boys the United States produces in such quantities, usually very reliable, but not exceptionally brilliant. He'd been on the moon for 3 years and was one of the first to bring his wife up from Earth when the ban on non-essential personnel was lifted. I'd never quite understood how he'd managed that. He must have been able to pull some strings, but certainly he was the last person you'd expect to find at the center of a worldwide conspiracy. Worldwide, did I say? No, it was bigger than that, for it extended all the way back to Earth. Dozens of people were involved, right up to the top brass of the Astronautics Authority. It still seems a miracle that they were able to keep the plot from leaking out. The slow sunrise had been underway for 2 days, Earth time, and though the needle-sharp shadows were shortening, it was still 5 days to noon. We were ready to make the first static tests of Alpha's motors, for the power plant had been installed and the framework of the ship was complete. It stood out there on the plain, looking more like a half-built oil refinery than a spaceship. But to us it was beautiful, with its promise of the future. It was a tense moment. Never before had a thermonuclear engine of such size been operated, and despite all the safety precautions that had been taken, one could never be sure. If anything went wrong now, it could delay Project Ares by years. The countdown had already begun when Hutchins, looking rather pale, came hurrying up to me. "I have to report to base at once," he said. "It's very important." "More important than this?" I retorted sarcastically, for I was mightily annoyed. He hesitated for a moment as if wanting to tell me something. Then he replied, "I think so." "Okay," I said, and he was gone in a flash. I could have questioned him, but one has to trust one's subordinates. As I went back to the central control panel, in rather a bad temper, I decided that I'd had enough of my temperamental young American and would ask for him to be transferred. It was odd, though. He'd been as keen as anybody on this test, and now he was racing back to base on the cable car. The blunt cylinder of the shuttle was already halfway to the nearest suspension tower, sliding along its almost invisible wires like some strange bird skimming across the lunar surface. 5 minutes later, my temper was even worse. A group of vital recording instruments had suddenly packed up, and the whole test would have to be postponed for at least 3 hours. I stormed around the blockhouse, telling everyone who'd listen, and of course everyone had to, that we used to manage things much better at Kapustin Yar. I'd quieted down a bit, and we were on our second round of coffee when the general attention signal sounded from the speakers. There's only one call with a higher priority than that, the wail of the emergency alarms, which I've heard just twice in all my years in the lunar colony, and hope never to hear again. The voice that echoed through every enclosed space on the moon and over the radios of every worker out on the soundless plains was that of General Moshe Stein, chairman of the Astronautics Authority. There were still lots of courtesy titles around in those days, though they didn't mean anything anymore. "I'm speaking from Geneva," he said, "and I have an important announcement to make. For the last 9 months, a great experiment has been in progress. We have kept it secret for the sake of those directly involved, and because we did not wish to raise false hopes or fears. Not long ago, you will remember, many experts refused to believe that men could survive in space. This time also, there were pessimists who doubted if we could take the next step in the conquest of the universe. We have proved that they were wrong. For now, I would like to introduce you to George Jonathan Hutchins, First Citizen of Space. There was a click as the circuit was rerouted, followed by a pause full of indeterminate shufflings and whisperings. And then, over all the moon and half the earth, came the noise I promised to tell you about, the most awe-inspiring sound I've ever heard in my life. It was the thin cry of a newborn baby, the first child in all the history of mankind to be brought forth on another world than Earth. We looked at each other in the suddenly silenced blockhouse, and then at the ships we were building out there on the blazing lunar plain. They had seemed so important a few minutes ago. They still were, but not as important as what had happened over in Medical Center and would happen again billions of times on countless worlds down all the ages to come. For that was the moment, gentlemen, when I knew that man had really conquered space.